This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's nearly time for the annual giving of gifts, and the fortunate will get something that makes them happy, and the even more fortunate, well, when he was a kid, Paul Stewart was one of those. Paul Stewart was an athlete. It could hardly have been otherwise. His grandfather played minor league baseball and coached the Chicago Blackhawks to the NHL championship in 1938, and Stewart's dad followed a similar path.
Well, my father was the three-sport coach at Boston English High.
Bill Stewart Jr. also taught at the high school and refereed college football, baseball, and hockey games. So young Paul, who always wanted to be with his dad, spent a lot of time at the rink where he was an official. Paul Stewart was especially fond of the penalty box, where he was sometimes in peculiar company.
I was safe there, and I was particularly safe because my dad used to have Haystacks Calhoun, the 700-pound wrestler, sit between players, and they only had one penalty box. I was sitting on Haystacks' lap as he watched the game. Who was a better babysitter than Haystacks Calhoun?
As a little kid, being at the rink was pure fun for Stewart, even when he wasn't on the ice, because if he wasn't skating, he was at the snack bar.
Well, the fellow that sold the French fries was a great guy, and his name was Tony, and he had two payphones just the side of his stand. And when the phone would ring, he'd jump over the top of the counter, and he'd say to me, "Paul, mind the store." And I would hand out the French fries for 25 cents, and he'd take a notebook out of his pocket, and he'd be writing notes. He was taking numbers for the horses.
A childhood spent in the company of his dad and hockey players, an enormous pro wrestler, and a bookie? What kid could ask for more? Come one particular Christmas time when he was still very much a kid, Paul Stewart had an answer for that question. He'd been charging around the arena on his big sister's hand-me-down figure skates. What other hockey player had to wear white and deal with toe picks? He wanted hockey skates, but he knew his dad didn't make much as a teacher and a coach, and dad didn't lead Paul to expect more than those white figure skates anytime soon.
He said, "You can learn to skate in those, and when you learn how to skate in those, maybe you'll get a better pair." And then one day, maybe a few weeks just before Christmas, John Bishop, who was running the skate shop, said, "I need a favor, Paul." I said, "What's that?" He said, "My nephew's just your size, and I'm going to get him this pair of skates for Christmas. Can you try them on?" So I said, "Okay." And they were a pair of hides, and they had blue skate tips on the end. I'll never forget them. I tried them on, and they fit. He said, "Ah, that's good." He says, "They should fit my nephew, too." And I remember taking them off reluctantly.
He didn't let you go out on the ice with him?
No. We just tried them on to see if they fit and put them back in the box. I took them off and said, "Well, I hope he has fun in them." And I remember running upstairs to get another box of French fries from the bookie. And not too long after, it was Christmas.
And there being four kids in the household, Christmas was a big deal in the Stewart family.
My brother had a train set, and there were all different types of toys that we all unwrapped, and of course the usual scarves and hats and scratchy stuff that we didn't even want to try on that our aunt sent us from California. So all the presents were unwrapped, and I remember my dad leaning against the wall right next to the Christmas tree, and he said, "Paul, I think there's one more present." And it was sort of tucked under the tree, but a little behind the couch. And I couldn't really see it. And I looked, and it said, "To Paul from Santa." And I opened it up, and it was those skates that I had tried on.
Maybe you have to be a hockey player to understand how great that Christmas was. If you're not, maybe this will help.
And I remember after putting them on and clomping around the living room, looking up at my dad, and he had his arms folded, and he had a smile on his face, and he winked. My dad, my mom, they gave me the best present ever because those skates took me everywhere.
Eventually, the skates and the skates that came after them took Paul Stewart to the NHL. His pro career also included a lot of bus rides to and from minor league burgs like New Haven, Birmingham, and Broome, wherever that may be. After he'd hung up his stick, Stewart would officiate more than 1,000 NHL games, His father witnessed both of Paul's careers with pride, and along the way, Stuart made a lot of friends in the game and beyond. And then several decades ago, Paul Stuart spent another memorable Christmas with his dad, their last one together, as it turned out.
My father was ill, and he was bent over and crippled like Yoda. He had a hump on his back, and his fingers were gnarled, and he was sick. And he was sitting in the den of the home that my grandfather had built with the money that he earned when he won the Stanley Cup with Chicago. So I got this little tree, and we put it up. And my dad and I were sitting there, and we had a drink, and we were listening to the Christmas music, and the lights were on, and it was nice and peaceful. And he said to me, "So, what was your best Christmas ever?" And I said to him, "The time when Santa brought me those skates." And he looked at me, he said, "Except for this, that was my favorite one, too."
Athletes, even the ones who don't make the pros, save stuff. Old jerseys, cracked baseball bats, footballs signed by their teammates. I figured maybe Paul Stuart had saved those Christmas skates. Nope.
I think my dad took them and gave them to another kid along the way.
After you'd probably outgrown them, moved on.
And skated practically through them. With my toes crunched up.
The memory of that Christmas, like the memory of those skates, will be with Paul Stuart as long as he's breathing, Christmas Day or not. Though maybe the focus is a little sharper this time of year, and sometimes, as Stuart imagines it, his dad isn't beside that tree. He's at the rink where the two of them spent so many hours together.
He's got his arms across the pipe like he would have at the old Boston Garden watching the game, or at the arena, talking out of the side of his mouth, his eyes focused on the puck, but never looking away from the game and saying, "Can you believe that guy?" I'm sure he's still shaking his head with me.
Yeah, and he's probably winking, too. Paul Stuart is currently the director of officiating for the East Coast Athletic Conference. It's time for three stories you should know. Sexual harassment allegations have reached ESPN and the NFL Network. Five former NFL players now employed by the networks have been suspended over sexual harassment allegations. There are also accusations against SportsCenter anchor John Buchegras and fellow ESPN employee Matthew Berry. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by SB Nation Charlotte Wilder. Hello, Charlotte.
Hi, Bill.
And by Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
The accusations that I spoke of against ESPN employees and men working at the NFL Network have me wondering if they are the result of the particular subcultures that are involved here, or is it the culture at large? We have talked at length sometimes about how great young male athletes learn early that they can get away with things that would land less athletic young men in trouble. Is the alleged sexual harassment at networks where men who are former athletes work a result of that? Or, as some people have said, does the way these organizations treat male athletes as heroes and women as cheerleaders or swimsuit models influence the way women are treated in the newsroom? Or is this alleged behavior no way different or distinguishable from sexual harassment committed by television anchors or movie producers or members of the U.S. Congress? I leave this question open. Charlotte, any answers for us?
Been thinking a lot about this fall. I don't think that any one subgroup of people are more likely to sexually harass or assault or put women in really terrible positions in the workplace more than any other. What I do think is that when power comes into play, men can be absolutely awful. If you look at any industry, anywhere where there are men treated as hero figures because they are a moneymaker for an organization, because they are a draw, because they feel kind of invincible in some way, they are more likely to abuse that power. And you could say that of athletes, maybe that could go to their head. You could also say that of guys who run hedge funds. You could also say that of, you know, someone who is high up at a media organization. I think it's a problem everywhere. It's a big problem in sports media. You know, it's not just the athletes. So I think it's important to keep that in mind and not sort of single out any one group, but try to fix this across the board.
Mike, sports world worse than any other world, or by focusing on sports world, do we let other worlds off the hook?
Actually, I do think it's worse, Bill, because there are just so few women in power within the world of sports, men's dominated team sports. I mean, you could rise to the highest level, literally, with never having a female supervisor. You know, that's not even true quite often with the military these days. So men can act and be rewarded without being tempered by women at all. And I do think, though, I have to say that the NFL Network allegations seem worse to me than against the two ESPN employees. At the NFL Network, it seemed to be kind of a cruel, crude harassment going on. A female employee's place of work, actually, her workplace was a men's bathroom, according to those reports. I still don't get that.
It's an awful problem everywhere, and I certainly don't mean to diminish the fact that it's a bad problem everywhere by bringing it up in sports. I hope people won't take it that way. Mike, let's move on to your topic.
Well, I happen to like the NFL, which is in all sorts of circles of society. Not a popular thing to say these days. I will watch a show. I will TiVo it. I will sometimes go back just to watch particular linemen play. I don't do this all the time. But when a game comes, like last week's game between the Patriots and the Steelers, I get excited. And so does America. This game set ratings records. And I do believe that President Trump's constant criticism of the NFL and players kneeling for the anthem has caused a slight dip in ratings. Other things could have caused that, but if you have the person with the biggest megaphone probably in the history of planet Earth constantly criticizing your product, I could see where that would have an 8% decline. But I got to tell you, this game had everything. I'm now going to channel Stefan, the character from Saturday Night Live. This game had everything. It had Brady. It had Gronk. It had Juju. It had Igo Rugo? Oh, that's the thing where your eyes go, it's a touchdown, but the rules go, it's not. And everyone was very upset with this. And I noticed so many people on Twitter tweeted right then, this is why people aren't watching the NFL. Rules you can't understand.
But they all were.
My point exactly. So I quite enjoyed this game. And if one of these two teams, and say the Eagles or some other marquee exciting matchup, rematch with the Falcons, if that's the Super Bowl, could set records again.
First of all, I will not only admit that I am a fan of football, I'm a fan of the Patriots, which is...
It's an easy thing to be.
Well, not a lot of people outside of New England like that, Bill, let me tell you. I don't think that the ratings decline or Trump or blech, you know, I'm kind of just so sick of all of it. You know, it's like people are still watching football. People probably will be watching football for a while. And I think that you can't discount sort of cord cutting or any of these other factors. I don't want to give Trump any credit for having any effect on this. Even thinking about that sort of drives me a little bit nuts. But I guess that's 2017 for you.
All right. Mike, first of all, you're right. I have this pre-existing notion that football should be less popular, and I really don't like the fact that you've troubled that pre-existing notion and caused it to wobble. I don't know whether we can draw any conclusions from one game or even one week's worth of games. I think maybe after the Super Bowl, when somebody crunches the numbers, we'll be able to know whether, in fact, the NFL has been in the process of becoming less popular. And until then, I'm going to cross my fingers and hope for the best. Mike, back to you.
You will hope that it became less popular.
Precisely
for the right
what I'm hoping. Yes, exactly. Yes, in the interest of saving the brains of players now and in the future.
There's that great line. Oh, I want to credit the person who said it, but I never thought in the great national divorce the Democrats would get football.
Yeah.
Charlotte, you're our closer this week. What have you got for us?
Oh, speaking of closers, let's talk about baseball. I want to talk about the fight that we all deserve to end this really weird dark dystopian year, Marlins Man versus Derek Jeter. now, for those of you who don't know Marlins Man, he is a lawyer named Lawrence Levy who lives in Miami and has season tickets to the Marlins, wears an orange visor and an orange shirt, and he also buys tickets to every big sporting event. So the World Series, you'd see a flash of orange in a sea of whatever team's colors. I actually met him and wrote about him when I was in Miami at the All-Star Game, and he said some troubling things about women and cheerleaders, and it was a trip, and not necessarily a good one. But Derek Jeter now has bought the Marlins and traded away Giancarlo Stanton, their best player, to his former team, the Yankees, which no one seems to be thrilled about. And Marlins,
except the Yankees.
Well, right. Sorry, I don't count them. and Marlins Man went to a town hall that Jeter had and stood up to the mic with a stack of papers and just sort of started assailing him. He was like, "Do you know who I am?" And Jeter said, "Well, I've heard of you." And Marlins Man said that he'd had offers from other teams to wear their jerseys and that he wasn't buying his season tickets again. Mm. And I just think that this is two people who don't have to be doing any of the things they're doing. I think it's somewhat telling.
Mike, do you foresee Marlins Man changing colors and teams?
Well, who would he become? Giants guy? Phillies fellow? Anaheim Angels amigo? Diamondbacks dude?
Diamondbacks dude, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. He raises a good point. It seems to me that Derek Jeter's motivation is essentially to harvest the Marlins for parts. It's like the plot of a sci-fi movie. Let's have a new kid via cloning, but we'll just use his parts for the old one. So once again, Marlins Man leads the way.
Well, it seems to me that fire sale is in this team's DNA. This is not the first time that the Marlins have divested themselves of everybody who could actually play baseball.
Right.
I wonder if Marlins fans, including Marlins Man, should have learned by now to shrug it off. If you're going to root for this team, this is what's going to happen, right?
Well, the first two times they did it, they got a World Series. But the last time they did it, they just got a overly expensive stadium that the taxpayers are still paying for.
Exactly.
I don't know what's going to happen this time that they've done it.
Tanking can work. Look at the Astros. I think tanking when there's not a sort of clear path forward, it can be way harder for fans to swallow, especially when you have a guy like Jeter, you know, from the Yankees coming in, getting rid of guys, going to the Yankees. It's really kind of hard to wrap your head around and see the silver lining. I hope there is one. I also just really hope that the Marlins don't get rid of their incredible home run dinger machine that has a dolphin jumping over a waterfall whenever anyone hits a home run. So if we can keep that, maybe everything will be okay.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Charlotte Wilder of SB Nation and Mike Pesca, the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Take care.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. Shout out to NHUSAA member for dropping this review on Apple Podcasts. I look forward to the latest episode each Saturday morning during my drive home from work. After a hectic overnight Friday shift as an emergency physician, this provides for such a wonderful, lighthearted, knowledge-packed 50 minutes. Thanks. May your emergencies be less hectic, NHUSAA member. In case they're not, we'll keep pumping out the necessary distractions. I hope you will consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening right now. We'd be very grateful. I'm Bill Littlefield. Althea Gibson is best known as the woman who integrated tennis, but not as many people have heard about Gibson's connection to another sport. Here's reporter Anya Alvarez.
In 1959, Renee Powell was a teenager in Canton, Ohio. Her sport was golf, not tennis. But even she appreciated just how big a deal it would be to meet the Althea Gibson. Gibson was one of the most famous athletes in the world. She'd recently won Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. She'd shaken hands with the Queen of England, even had a ticker tape parade in New York City. And now she was stopping in Powell's hometown for a table tennis exhibition. Powell's parents took her to the event, hoping their daughter might get to meet the tennis star.
And by the time we went backstage, she had already gone and didn't meet her. I was so disappointed.
A year later, Powell traveled to Boston to play in a tournament arranged by the United Golfers Association. The UGA was an organization for black golfers. At first, it seemed like any other UGA tournament, and then Powell learned the name of her playing partner.
And I was paired with Althea Gibson, so it was like, really, wow, here she is on the golf course.
The world-famous Althea Gibson had left tennis in the prime of her career and turned to golf. Althea Gibson was born in 1927. She was a daughter of sharecroppers from South Carolina. But Althea grew up in Harlem on 143rd Street. Back then, 143rd was classified as a play area for children by the Police Athletic League. Here, Althea's love for sport was nourished, but so was her penchant for trouble.
So her upbringing was literally on the streets of Harlem.
That's filmmaker Rex Miller, who has made a documentary about Althea's life. Her father, Daniel Gibson, believed Althea could become a great athlete, and he was tough. Some days he would take her up on the roof to box. He thought she could someday make a living fighting. But it was Althea's street cred at paddle tennis, a sport popular with New York City children, that caught the attention of Buddy Walker, a man who played in the house band at Sugar Ray Robinson's bar in Harlem.
And he saw her ability, and he brought her out of the play streets and took her to the Cosmopolitan Club.
This was a black tennis club in Harlem that catered to lawyers, doctors, and professors. Althea, whose life was more hard knock than country club, had a hard time fitting in.
As they like to tell the story, she was a little rough around the edges, but a lot of folks at the Cosmopolitan Club mentored her not only in tennis, but also just how to conduct herself in this new group of people that she was being exposed to.
Althea's favorite word, according to those close to her, no. Still, Althea excelled on the tennis court. She was so dominant that she caught the attention of two black doctors from the South.
They were both self-described race men, interested in breaking barriers, early participants in the civil rights movement. They saw in her the Jackie Robinson of tennis. So when she was 18, they came to her and they said that we think that you could get into Forest Hills, which was the U.S. Nationals, the precursor of the U.S. Open. We think you could go play at Wimbledon, and we'd like to help you get there.
Althea agreed to move to Wilmington, North Carolina to train. Over the next 4 years, she attended a local high school and practiced tennis on a court behind the house of one of her sponsors. In 1949, she enrolled at Florida A&M University on a full athletic scholarship. A year later, at the age of 23, she became the first black woman to play at the U.S. Open. In 1957, Althea won Wimbledon, becoming the first African-American to do so. Soon after, she won the U.S. Open. She had become the number one player in the world. But against the hopes of the doctors who had supported her, Althea didn't speak out about race relations in the U.S.
She was very much a reluctant icon. She was just used to saying no. Plus, it's one thing in the late 60s when the civil rights movement was embraced more by mainstream America. But in the 50s, I mean, you're talking about Emmett Till and Brown versus Board of Education. Speaking out was something that not only could get you ostracized, but it could also get you killed.
And despite Althea's success on the tennis court, she struggled financially. Back then, there was no prize money in major tennis championships, and the opportunity to earn a check competing in open tournaments did not come until 1968. Althea lived with roommates, she had no real income, and she survived off the generosity of others. In 1958, Althea decided to move on from tennis.
She was clearly the most dominant player of that era. And she would have kept going, like, you know, she could have won multiple titles over the next few years, but she quit because she had to go make a living.
Althea signed a deal to play tennis before Harlem Globetrotter games. After a year with the Globetrotters, she tried singing.
I can't give you anything but love, baby.
She sang on the Ed Sullivan Show, and she cut an album with Dot Records of jazz standards, but, you know, it didn't go anywhere for her.
She even appeared in a movie with John Wayne, Horse Soldiers.
Here's your brandy, sir.
Oh, thank you.
And it's all tested.
Althea still wasn't able to make a living. So in 1960, she turned to a sport she'd picked up at Florida A&M, golf. At the time, there wasn't much money in golf, but at least she'd have the chance to earn a little money. So that's how Renee Powell, the young Althea fan from Canton, Ohio, finally had the chance to meet her on the golf course in Boston.
You know, Althea would hit the golf ball. It was amazing because she was so strong. But she would hit it. It didn't go high. It went low, but it went. It kept going.
Althea didn't just need to learn a new set of skills. She also had to learn a new set of rules. But in 1964, Althea earned a spot on the LPGA and became the first black woman to join the tour. 3 years later, Renee Powell followed in Althea's footsteps and also qualified for the tour. Those are not easy times for African Americans, and it was no different on the golf course.
First of all, she was not invited to the social events, ever.
There were tournaments where she wasn't even allowed to use restrooms. She had to change her shoes in the car.
But Renee says Althea found an ally in LPGA veteran Marlene Hagee.
There was one incident when Althea had gone to a hotel, and they couldn't find her reservation. They conveniently lost her reservation. And Marlene walked in, and Althea was had been trying to register. And Marlene said, "What's the problem?" Althea told her what was going on. And Marlene said, "Well, Althea, just stand here for a second." And Marlene registered. And then she asked the person behind the desk, "I need two keys." And so right in front of this person, she goes, "Here, Althea." She gave her a key. She said, "You're rooming with me."
But Althea never found anywhere near the success she had in tennis. With only one second-place finish and a couple other decent finishes, she earned just over $19,000 over the course of her 13-year career.
She never really tore up the golf tour. She struggled with traveling expenses and training expenses.
I remember her telling me one time how fortunate I was to have had, you know, my family was my big support, and they were always there, and she relayed to me that she had been on her own since she was 14 years old.
Althea Gibson left the LPGA in 1977 and accepted a position as a tennis pro in New Jersey near her home. Gradually, she became even more reclusive. Renee Powell was one of the few people whose calls Althea would take.
I could say, what a beautiful blue sky, and her sky was gray. So it was difficult having conversations in those latter days because, you know, she was not in the happiest state of her life.
One day in 1995, Althea called her former tennis doubles partner, Angela Buxton.
And Althea said, "Oh, I'm just calling you to say goodbye." And Angela said, "Goodbye? Why? Where are you going? Are you leaving? Are you traveling?" And Althea told her the story about how she didn't have any money, and her health was bad, and she just didn't see any reason to go on, so she was just calling to say goodbye.
Concerned, Angela got a letter published in Tennis Week magazine detailing Althea's financial straits and asked the tennis community for help.
And a month or two later, Althea got just envelope after envelope after envelope sent directly to her home in New Jersey. And as the story goes, it was full of money of all different currencies from people who had watched her and fans who had admired her. So even though this came relatively late in her life, it still gave her a little bit of comfort.
After years of health problems, Althea died of respiratory failure in 2003. While the world has known Althea as a tennis legend, her time in golf has been undervalued. But still, her legacy exists.
I go to tournaments now and nobody's telling me, you know what, I don't, you know, at least not to my face, you know, I don't want you here.
That's 23-year-old Mariah Stackhouse, one of four black players currently on the LPGA Tour, along with Ginger Howard, Sedina Parks, and Cheyenne Woods. Last year, Mariah played at the LPGA Cambia Portland Classic. She was on the putting green and noticed something.
You know, I don't know how it started, but it might have been me and Ginger talking, and then Sedina pops up, and then boom, there's Cheyenne, and we're like, oh, wow, we're all here together right now.
It was the first time four black players were at the same LPGA event.
You know, we all kind of got together to take a group picture to just kind of commemorate that moment and high-five each other and, like, say, you know, we're here.
That's LPGA golfer Mariah Stackhouse speaking with reporter Anya Alvarez. For more on Althea Gibson's life, check out Rex Miller's documentary, Althea. In 1896, Susan B. Anthony gave an interview.
She said that bicycles did more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. And I thought, why is this feminist icon talking about a piece of athletic equipment, basically?
Why indeed? And what does that have to do with schoolgirls in Kenya in 2017? The answers are just ahead on Only a Game. And as always, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and hang on, don't hit that double fast-forward arrow for a second, because I want to tell you about another WBUR podcast I know you're going to love. After all, it's called Modern Love, and it's a collaboration between WBUR and the New York Times, featuring true stories of love, loss, and redemption performed by noteworthy actors.
In any marriage, even the best marriage, there will come a day when you wonder why you married this person.
She's dead to me, I told my friends.
Why did I throw away the best thing I ever had, I wrote in my journal. Please, God, bring her back.
It's easy to love the beautiful, the normal. But what about the gifts of loving the strange, the uncommon, the odd?
Modern Love, the podcast from WBUR and the New York Times. Subscribe right now on your favorite podcast app for a new episode every week.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, stories about items indispensable to athletic success, coffee makers, for example. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Diddy, formerly known as P. Diddy, wants to buy the Carolina Panthers. Colin Kaepernick wants to be part of Diddy's ownership group. I guess that's one way to get a job as a quarterback.
I think that would be so great. I would actually cover the first owners meeting where they all have to sit down with Colin Kaepernick and Diddy.
While the Panthers wait to see who will next own the team, Tina Becker is going to serve as the club's chief operating officer, which, as I understand it, is pretty much the only job she has not previously held with the team.
Yeah, it looks like she's worked her way up to the top.
Absolutely.
Job. Absolutely. And just was waiting around for the idiot owner to do something that everybody knew was coming sooner or later, that he was going to do something so stupid that it would cost him the team.
The Clemson City Council announced this week that if the Clemson University football team makes it to the national championship game on January 8th, the South Carolina city will suspend open container laws because nobody would be obeying them anyway.
That's exactly what's going on. The police, this is a day where the police want to work as little as possible.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Kehlani Nava booted 9 extra points for Strawn School in the Texas Class 1A six-man Division II championship game on Wednesday. This was in Dallas. Her team won the game 78-42. Did you catch the pronoun use there?
Yes. How about that?
Yeah.
Good for Kehlani. Hopefully she'll get a scholarship right out of this.
First female to play in a Texas title game, and when she had the opportunity, she made the most of it.
Yes, she did.
Her.
We're working our way up through the various descriptors in Texas football, I see.
Exactly. Hall of Fame broadcaster Dick Enberg passed away on Thursday. Charlie, he was 82. Any remembrances you'd like to share about him?
First of all, he was a great, great broadcaster. Second of all, he was probably one of the nicest men who ever lived. And he will always be, in my memory, teamed with Al McGuire on college basketball.
Mm-hmm. The logo that's going to be worn by athletes from Russia at the Winter Olympics was revealed this week. Charlie, would you like to describe it to our listeners? I don't think it'll take very long.
It looks like an old-time gasoline station sign.
Yes, it does.
It's a circle. It starts with Olympic athlete from Russia,
mm-hmm.
which is very generic, I think.
About
they could have at least had it in Russian.
That's kind of the point, though. The logo for the 2018 World Chess Championships was also revealed this week.
Oh,
and
my.
I would ask you to describe that in detail for our listeners, but if you did, it might provoke the premature end of two promising careers in radio.
Yeah, I'm telling you what, this brings Knight to Queen 6 into a whole new level.
Oh, I know, yes. Attention must be paid to two coaches of women's basketball teams. This week, Gino Auriemma presided over win number 1,000 at UConn, and North Carolina's Sylvia Hatchell did the same.
Yeah, that's terrific. But I've got to tell you, I thought Gino Auriemma went over 1,000 wins years ago.
Yeah, I think the remarkable thing about Gino Auriemma is he's got 1,000 wins and 11 losses.
Yeah.
No, that's wrong, no. But it's close.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems to me like this is a landmark he must have gone by 5 years ago.
I know, I hear you. Among Division I coaches, only the late Pat Summitt of Tennessee and Stanford's Tara Vanderveer had previously reached and surpassed the 1,000 victory mark, as has some guy named Krzyzewski at Duke with a men's team. Four coaches of women's basketball have gotten there, one of men's. How come?
Well, because there was a competitive imbalance in women's basketball for a long, long time.
Kyle O'Quinn has been having a pretty good season with a Knicks team that's a little better than most folks thought it would be. He's also pursuing a part-time career, perhaps in case the pro basketball thing doesn't last. What's he up to?
He's been hiring himself out to do bar mitzvahs.
He's the tallest man in every bar mitzvah.
Today I am a man, but this one is really big.
The New York Islanders have been playing in Brooklyn's Barclays Center since 2015 after decades at Long Island's Nassau Coliseum. But Brooklyn's going to lose them just like they lost the Dodgers 60 years ago, I guess. Maybe not just like that.
Yeah, they're going to build a new arena on the grounds of the Belmont Racetrack. It's still not going to make me nostalgic for Uniondale, whatever they do.
There is still fighting in hockey, Charlie.
I love this.
Even in the Austrian Pro Hockey League. Last Sunday, Tom Zanoski and Chris D'Souza squared off during an intermission interview. Come on, boys.
First of all, the video is wonderful. People should seek it out. Second of all, the intermission reporter took a butt end.
Yeah.
One of the two players, I couldn't figure out who is which, apparently missed and hit the reporter.
You know, I got to wonder if anybody else is reminded of the opening scene from Slapshot, where the goalie is explaining to the announcer all the penalties.
Yes.
And he stabs him with a stick and he whacks him across the knees.
That's right.
Finally.
Merry Christmas, Charlie Villanueva.
Condolences to that former NBA player, Charlie Villanueva. He was the victim of an exceedingly grinchy trick this week. What did he lose when the burglars got into his house? Jewelry, irreplaceable family photographs?
All of his home appliances, Bill, including the toilet. Now, this was a very elaborate burglary, you have to admit.
Capella brought tools with him.
Yeah, I guess he did, and considerable plumbing skills.
And muscle. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill. Merry Christmas.
This week, some number of kids in the U.S. are going to wake up to bicycles under a tree. Or maybe they've already received them for Hanukkah or their birthdays, or just because their parents found a little extra money in the budget. Worldwide, 145,000 students in developing countries have received bicycles through World Bicycle Relief, and their lives have been changed. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
This is Diana.
My name is Diana Mwanika.
Diana is 19 years old. She lives in Kenya's western province, and she's friends with Angela. They go to school together.
My name is Angela Haluire. I'm 17 years old, and I study at Bukhayo Secondary School.
Diana wants to study agriculture so that she can help her community avoid food shortages. Angela wants to be a doctor. A few years ago, Angela's father promised to buy her a bicycle if she studied hard and became the top student in her class.
So when I became number one and he did not buy me a bicycle, I felt so angry with him.
Why did he not buy you a bicycle?
He told me that there was no money to buy me the bicycle.
School fees are expensive in Kenya. Many families decide there's not enough money to educate their girls. So Diana and Angela are lucky. Here's Diana.
My family have been very much supportive. They struggle much to get the fees so that they can pay for me to get the education.
World Bicycle Relief's Matt Pierce has spoken with Diana's parents.
They said, quite frankly, that they had a choice. They could either re-roof their home. They could invest in more cattle. I think they had one cow, and they had, you know, thought about expanding that, you know, or they could purchase other goods for their home. And they said, no, we've chosen to forego all of those things because we want to invest in our daughter's education, because that will really benefit us in time.
Despite the support from their families, Diana and Angela had a problem. They live far from their school.
My home is 4 kilometers to and fro to school. I used to walk from home to school, and it was tiresome and wasted a lot of time.
And along the way, there are dangers.
There is a road that all of the students have to travel to get to school.
On the way, there are very many distractors, those boda-boda men.
These are motorcycle drivers, many of them young guys that maybe dropped out or can't find other employment.
If the girls are late for school, they won't be allowed in the classroom. And the boda-boda drivers know when the girls are running late.
So they offer students, you know, rides to get to school. So we heard time and time again that girls were being mistreated, you know, by these boda-boda drivers.
It was very disturbing. I was very much scared because, after all, they only want to destroy our life by impregnating us.
Impregnating is not a euphemism. The boda-boda drivers really do want to get these schoolgirls pregnant.
They know that their life is somewhat capped, topped off, and they want to bring the girls down with them. They don't want to see them soar and fly.
That's Leah Misbach Day. She's the co-founder of World Bicycle Relief. One day, not too long ago, the principal at Bukaiwa Secondary School made an announcement. Here's Diana.
People from World Bicycle Relief, they've come and they would like to donate to us the bicycles. Those who are interested were to apply.
But there was one catch. World Bicycle Relief would only give out the bicycles according to a set ratio.
70% for girls and 30% for boys.
That ratio, 70% for the girls, 30% for the boys, it was an issue. Because even though the parents of the girls at Bukaiwa Secondary School believed in educating their daughters, letting them ride bicycles was something else altogether.
Because culturally, girls riding bicycles in that area was not common. So it's a conversation, it's a back and forth, and it's something where we say, you know, we're only going to do this program with that ratio.
World Bicycle Relief doesn't just use that 70-30 ratio at schools where girls are being harassed by boda-boda drivers. They use it all over the world. Because, as it turns out, there's a long history of women's lives in particular being changed by the bicycle. And we might as well start that story with Susan B. Anthony.
Well, that's kind of where I started, so it is a good place to start.
That's Sue Macy. A few years back, she was researching a book about Nellie Bly.
It was Nellie Bly. That's what it was. Right. So Nellie Bly was a journalist, one of the first investigative reporters of any gender, and one of the first female reporters of the day. And so she was a feminist, and she loved to interview famous women. So at one point, she interviewed Susan B. Anthony, and Susan B. Anthony declared that she stands and salute every time she sees a bicycle.
And this was the part that really caught Sue Macy's attention.
She said that bicycles did more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. And I thought, why is this feminist icon talking about a piece of athletic equipment, basically?
Yeah, I mean, when I first read that quote, I think, that can't possibly be true.
Right, right. But it was. The 1890s, when the bicycle explosion took place in the United States, women led rather restricted lives.
Women's clothing was restrictive. They wore corsets and long, heavy skirts. Their movements were restricted. Unmarried women were rarely allowed to go anywhere without a chaperone. Their physical activity was restricted. They were kept indoors to protect their delicate constitutions.
And the bicycle changed all that. Suddenly, they needed clothes that were more practical for riding a bike. So for practical reasons, clothing started to get more reasonable, more rational, as they called it then.
And there was something else going on. Women were discovering that they were capable of more than they had ever dreamed.
Frances Willard, who was the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, wrote a book about how she learned to ride a bicycle at age 53. And she not only learned to ride the bicycle, she learned to take it apart and put it together.
But there was one prominent feminist of the day who didn't learn to ride a bike, Susan B. Anthony.
She did not. But she was older by then, by the 1890s. She never rode a bicycle, but she appreciated it.
Yeah, it must have been a thing for her to look out the window and see women riding by.
Yeah, well, because when you're an older woman who's, you know, led the struggle all these years, and then you suddenly see women breaking out, it must have been pretty gratifying.
But what does Susan B. Anthony have to do with Diana and Angela at Bukhaiwa Secondary School in Western Kenya? Well, no one's suggesting that Western Kenya today is just like the United States in the 1890s. But Leah Misbach-Day says that research shows that by focusing on girls, World Bicycle Relief can have a bigger positive impact on the community than if they were to just hand out half the bicycles to boys and half to girls.
When the bicycles start to come into the community and the girls and the adults can see how it's working, they dream into a different and bigger future.
When World Bicycle Relief first came to the Bukhaiwa Secondary School, Matt Pierce says it wasn't easy to find enough girls whose parents would agree to let them receive a bicycle.
Girls riding bicycles in that area was not common.
But when World Bicycle Relief came back for the second distribution at the school,
the principal and vice principal said that the applications were overflowing.
Diana and Angela received their bicycles during that second distribution. But even though they had both seen others at their school riding bikes, they still weren't sure they could do it themselves. Here's Angela.
Some of my friends told me that I could get hurt. So that got me worried. I saw other girls riding, so I just felt it is simple, and in a few moments, I was able to ride it also. So some of the students, we were competing in the road because everybody wanted to see that he knew how to ride better than the others. On the road, you are competing. Everyone is riding the bicycle that day we were given, so we are feeling like we are flying.
Diana and Angela both say that their bicycles help them to get to school on time. They make it possible for them to finish their chores and their schoolwork and still get a little sleep. But outside of school hours, the bicycles are changing their community in all sorts of ways. Adults use them to get grain to the mill. One student told World Bicycle Relief that she's used hers to take her grandmother to church on Sundays. But what about those Boda Boda drivers waiting by the side of the road, hoping to bring the young girls down? Diana says they're not a problem anymore.
You pass by them very fast and they can't disturb you. So I'm very glad about that.
That's Diana Monica speaking with Only a Game's Karen Given. We'll have links to Sue Macy's book, Wheels of Change, more information about World Bicycle Relief, and videos of Diana and Angela at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Diana Monica, who explains why it's important for girls to get an education.
I think if girls are given the opportunity, they'll do much great in the nation.
And you will get no argument from me, Diana. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.